Hello there. Welcome to Cool Climate Living. I'm Susan Lacey. Here in the Central West, we're privileged to have a fertile and productive environment to produce much of Australia's food. Farming is a way of life for many of our population, and it's a lifestyle that gives a lot of personal satisfaction. It's no wonder people from the cities want to come and visit and experience being on the land just for a short time. Today, we'll hear from farmers living on the land to share their experience and challenges. From one of 2MCE's presenters with 60 years of farming experience, a wine grower and maker, and then another farmer who'll talk about his best farming asset, his working dogs. I'd like to welcome Jeff Cox to the program. And for those of you who are regular 2MCE listeners, will have heard Jeff Cox many, many times before because he's a 2MCE presenter and he presents on
Thursday morning breakfast, yes, 7 o'clock Thursday morning for the chairman's breakfast.
That's right. Chairman Jeff.
Yes, and I'm the chairman of the breakfast club for Thursday morning.
Yes. Jeff, thank you very much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Susan.
Now, besides being a 2MCE presenter, Jeff has also been a farmer for 60 years.
Yes.
And across.
Long time.
Victoria and New South Wales.
That's correct.
And his farming has been in sheep and cattle, cropping and dairy farming.
That's right.
So covered practically every base.
Yes. Even ventured into goat farming at one stage as well. 500 of them.
Oh no, that's too many. Jeff, tell us about how you got started in farming.
Well, I was born on a dairy farm that my parents owned. We were living at Dean's Marsh in Victoria. But before that, I was born in Seymour, Victoria, which is where my parents first started farming. After the Second World War, Dad was allocated a farm, soldier settler's farm, and he started off with sheep and a small dairy on the property. And then we left Seymour in 1954 and moved to Dean's Marsh down near the Great Ocean Road, actually, over the Otway Ranges. And after I completed my schooling in 1960, I then went home permanently and worked on the dairy farm with my mum and dad.
And when you were a kid, you would have been working on the farm,
yes,
as well, wouldn't you?
Every evening after school, after we had cycled on our push bikes 3.5 miles from the school back home, down to the dairy to help the evening milking.
And after being at Dean's Marsh, you went around to other places as,
yes,
an adult too, didn't you?
Yes, but before that, with my parents again, we moved to Camperdown on the way to Warrnambool. And my parents purchased a dairy farm there, and I was there till 1968, and then moved out of dairying onto sheep and cattle farming as a station hand. That was at Birragurra, little old Birragurra,
right,
which is sort of between Colac and Dean's Marsh down there in the Western District.
Very fertile soil around there, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. Typical sheep farming, dairy farming practices. Cropping is done in that area too, but mainly animals.
So once you'd finished with Victoria, yes, you came to New South Wales, didn't you?
That's right, yes. Moved to Goulburn, right up on the top of the Great Dividing Range at Gurunda. That's the name of the area. And all our family went to the Gurunda Public School there. And the property was a syndicate-owned property from various people from overseas. Merle Oberon, the actress, was one of those who had a share in that property. 10,000 acres we had there, a very large property. And I started off as an overseer and ended up being assistant manager on the property. Mm. We had great experiences there. And that's where we had the 500 goats on one occasion, as well as 10,000 sheep and 300 or 400 head of cattle.
That's, yeah, huge.
Well, 10,000 acres, that's a huge property.
Yeah.
Wonderful soil country, cropping as well. Yes, all types of farming.
And then where did you go?
From Goulburn, we came to Rocklea. Yes, Rocklea, just south of right here where we are, Bathurst.
How did you choose Rocklea?
The job that was available was a manager's job. So I was assistant manager at Goulburn.
Oh, it's a good career
step,
move, yeah.
The next step was to be manager, outright manager. And this position came up, and I became the manager of 2,000 acres, virtually on my own, and I would get contract labour in to do various jobs, cropping, shearing time. I'd get contract shearers in to do this actual shearing. I would just organise everything.
So you had sheep and cattle?
Yes, and cropping.
And cropping?
Yes.
That great big broad range.
Yes.
And you were there for a long time, weren't you?
Yes, ended up being there for 25 years and would still be there if I hadn't had that darn motorbike accident.
What happened?
Just mustering sheep in the paddock. It was a two-wheel motorbike, none of these quad bikes at that stage. And the wheels got caught in a sheep rut. The sheep, they have tracks all over the paddock, and those tracks become ruts. And the wheels got stuck in the rut, and in trying to get the wheels out, one of my legs snapped. It went out to the side and snapped. And that was my downfall ever since, and that is now some 14 years ago since that happened. And I ended up having lots of blood circulation problems and blood clots and lots of dramas. But before that, I had 25 years of wonderful lifestyle, which was what farming is all about. It's a lifestyle.
Yes.
As a manager, it wasn't my property, but I treated it as my property. And the owners were just excellent people from Sydney that just gave me full control on how I operated things.
Yeah, you like to be independent, don't you?
Yes, but I did have guidance through an agricultural management firm as well while I was at Rockley. So there was the owner of the property, the management firm, and myself all involved with operating the property there.
Now, besides your motorcycle accident, I imagine that farming has lots of all kinds of dramas.
Yes, it can go from too much rain, and an oat crop would be just ready to harvest in January, and then all of a sudden we'd get 4 or 5 inches of rain and the crop would be on the ground and, you know, virtually a total loss.
Yeah.
And then the other spectrum of no rain and you're in drought conditions. And in 1979 through to 1983, the property at Goulburn, which I was on, was in drought conditions for all those years.
Mm.
We claim to have had a drought here right now, but nothing to what Goulburn went through in those years back then. Yeah.
And how did you save your stock?
We had to downsize all the stock. As I said, we had several hundred of cattle, head of cattle, and what we did is we drafted off all the top breeders and we put 8 to 10 cattle in every paddock. And with 10,000 acres, you have, you know, 30 or more paddocks. So you're able to distribute just 8 or 10 in every paddock, and they just had to look after themselves. It wasn't profitable to feed them all because for so many years. And they existed by themselves. And the sheep were just downsized, the sheep, and just handled what we could, feeding grain to our breeders, because we were in fat lambs, raising fat lambs there, as well as merinos, growing merino wool. And yes, you just had to change your routine and carry on.
Farming with sheep and cattle and dairy cattle and goats.
Yes.
Now, which of those are the easiest to deal with?
Well, the goats are the hardest, because you can imagine mustering them into your sheep yards. And sheep yards are just low fences, and a low fence won't stop a goat at all.
That's right.
These were Angora goats, so they had to be shorn.
Right.
And we get them into the shearing shed, and of course put them in the pens, and they'll be jumping from one pen to the other. The fences anywhere were never a hurdle, never a problem for a goat. And then when it came to catching one of the goats, one person would have to hang on to his head, standing upright.
Yeah.
You don't lay them down like a sheep to shear them. Hang on to their head. Another person hangs on to his tail. And then you get your handpiece and away you go. And it's mainly just over the rib cage is where you get the best Angora hair. So it's just each side of a goat. And then when that's done, let the thing go. And you can imagine he's squealing all the time.
I was just going to ask, was he very impressed?
Not at all, no. And you had to take precautions while shearing because of the fine hair, the fine mohair, it floats in the air and gets into your lungs. The operator would have to wear a mask to prevent that from happening. But you take all those things part of the operation and you finally get there.
Tell us a story about the cattle that you've been working with.
Well, right at the start, the dairy cattle were all Jerseys. They were considered the best cream and butterfat producers. Mm-hmm. Then it came a time where whole milk was in demand. So we then went into Frisians. And they had bigger quantities of milk as well, and that's what you were paid for. And then into beef cattle, I worked on the properties on Hereford beef cattle lines, and then came to Rockley, and we had Angus.
Angus are all the go, really, aren't they?
Yes,
very popular. Breed,
very popular.
Are they easy to deal with?
It all depends on the breed, and all cattle have their problems, but you breed the best quality animal and anything that's not quiet to work with, you cull out. So eventually
get rid of the troublemakers, you mean.
Exactly. Yes, and then you have this line of easy working, and it becomes the temperament is milder. Therefore, when they have a calf, it follows on in the genes and away it goes. And you end up with easy to work with stock. Mm. And they produce better too because they're not running around like hairy goats and running all the fat condition off their body.
Yeah.
So, yes, you breed it into whichever breed line that you are working with.
Reflecting back onto your career in farming, can you remember any particularly joyful moments?
Oh, joyful moments. Yes, when I left the dairying industry, I was very happy because I was born onto a dairy farm, not of my choice, and milking the cattle twice a day, every day, Saturday, Sunday, no holidays. Well, all my mates were going off to camps and having a great time, but that wasn't a joyful time at all. That was one of the reasons I moved from dairying onto general farming with sheep and cattle. Mm. And I got to enjoy working with sheep, which is most people's surprise because
I always thought that sheep were an awful lot of trouble.
No, it's all in the handling of the animal. It's the way you handle them. They're not dumb. Sheep are supposed to be dumb. Mm. But a lot of the times it's the operator who's dumb in the way he handles them. Mm. That was my experience anyway.
Yeah.
When you understood, the animal, things worked out pretty well.
Mm. So did they get lots of horrible diseases?
The sheep, they're always susceptible to a worm problem, and that's what they pick up in the pastures.
Yeah.
But if you keep a program going of prevention by deworming them at certain times through the year, that will avoid them getting sick. So therefore, they're fitting well.
Mm.
But there's lots of different precautions that you have to take with not only drenching but delousing them. In other words, if they prevent them from getting lice, because that they lose condition if they have lice and don't produce the wool, so you've got to dip them. These days it's much easier. You have pour-on liquids that you pour onto the animal, and that does the job.
Yeah.
In the good old days, in my day, we had to put them through a plunge dip.
Yeah.
And that was quite a job to do.
Well, yeah, and those chemicals couldn't have been good for you either.
At the start, yes. Not good at all. But as time went on, more suitable chemicals were developed. And the pour-ons are supposed to be very friendly to work with.
So were these sheep just for wool or for meat as well?
Both. We had a certain number of merino wethers for breeding wool.
Mm.
That was when wool was valuable back in the 70s or 60s and 70s. And then there was a turnaround when wool plummeted and became a liability. Mm. These days it's a wonderful situation for both meat sheep and for wool, prices are sky high compared to when I was fully involved in the 70s and 80s.
Did you do your own butchery?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm. You always provided your own meat from sheep that you had, yes. We would have a paddock of killers. And that was where our rations were, in the killer's paddock.
Yeah, yeah.
So we would get a killer out every one or every second week, and then do the appropriate job, hang him up in the shearing shed, put the meat bag over him, and come back in a couple of days when everything was nice and firm and cured, and chop it all up, and that was our meat ration on the farm. Yeah, fresh as a daisy.
Lamb chops every night.
could be, yes.
Now, just reflecting back in that really long career that you've had, what do you think you found most satisfying?
Satisfying? Oh, the produce that you produced on the properties, like when you had some fat lambs, we call them prime lambs now, not fat lambs, and to realise that it was you who got them to that situation, and then they go to market and you get a fabulous price. You get top price. That's a very pleasurable situation to be in.
Yeah.
Anything that you produce yourself, it's got to be a good thing. Yeah.
And what do you think the challenges are for younger people these days who are getting into farming? So I hope, thank God, we've still got plenty of farms around. We can produce a lot of our own food here in Australia. But if you were able to give some advice, what would it be?
Stay with it. Persevere. You're going to have bad times, and hopefully you'll have some good times. So, yes, farming is a way of life, I found. And even though I never owned any property through my years, I treated whatever property I was managing as my own. And then I would get a reward from the things that I developed on that farm. Like at Rockley, I end up planting 10,000 eucalyptus trees on the property. That was something pleasurable that I got out of it, because now, some 30 years after I first went there, I can see mature trees
when I go back for all the stock,
when I go back to visit the farm.
Yeah.
Yes, or to stop erosion along creek banks and things like that. So that's a pleasurable thing that you get out of farming. But there are lots of you can sleep in, you know, you can have a sleep in on a particular morning without having to write a note to the boss so I won't be there today. But then of course come Saturday and Sunday there's jobs that have to be done, and you just automatically do them. Come Monday and Tuesday, well, you might go for a trip somewhere,
right?
Yeah,
you're your own person, aren't you?
Yes, when you're the manager of a property or the owner of a property, the same thing applies. Yes. Yeah.
Well, it sounds as if you've had a fantastic career and you've loved it.
Very enjoyable. Yes. Mm-mm. Yeah, definitely. If it wasn't for farming, I'd be a school teacher.
Do you think so?
I would like to have done that. I love kids. I've had six of my own, so that's a fair indication.
Yeah.
That would have been either teaching or where I am now at 2MCE, radio broadcasting. Yeah. I've always been keen on the aspect of radio broadcasting.
Yeah.
But with farming, never even thought about taking it on until I retired here in Bathurst. And guess where I am now? Twice a week, three times a week.
Chairman Jeff is on the air.
Absolutely.
We've been listening to Chairman Jeff Cox, and thank you very much for telling us some fantastic stories in all this career you've had. Now, Jeff, to finish off this segment, what kind of music do you want me to play?
Well, I have a pin-up lady from Year Dot with Doris Day. She's been my pin-up idol from the years of Calamity Jane and then through all her movies. And I've been following her lifestyle. And now she is 96, will be 97 in April. And the music has just been appealing to me all the way through. Whatever will be a memorable little song from the 60s. The favourite of all was the film Calamity Jane. And it's the film that the television stations repeat over and over again and never become boring at all. And so the song from that particular movie is The Black Hills of Dakota with Doris Day.
Now, Jeff, when it is April, are you going to do a special program on Doris Day?
Definitely. You try and stop me.
All right, listeners, now you know where to go to when in April if you want to hear more Doris Day. Jeff, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Susan.
Introduce Mark Renzaya. Mark has a vineyard just out of O'Connell, and he and his wife have had the business since 1994. Mark, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Now, Mark, how long have you been involved in working on vineyards?
Well, Susan, I've been involved in the vineyard game since the early 80s, and this was back in the U.S. because my father, when he retired from his university job, decided he wanted to, he was only 62 years old and he still had a lot of energy left, and he wanted to grow grapes and start a winery. So in Illinois, he did that, and I was in my late 20s at that stage, maybe a little bit younger, and that's when I first kind of got introduced to grape growing and winemaking. So I had already embarked on a different career at that time, totally unrelated to growing grapes and making wine. But the bug was just started to hit me. And then I traveled overseas and went to Germany and France and Italy and tasted different wines. And that was in my mid-20s when I first really drank any wine. But from then on, it just kind of got a more and more serious addiction, I guess. And I just got carried away. Yeah.
Now, you've also worked around properties around the Central West as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I moved to Australia with my wife, Sandy, in the late 80s. And at that stage, I knew I wanted to have a change of career, involved in the vineyard and winery in Illinois. But I knew I wanted to change careers and be full-time in the grape and wine industry. So the first thing I did was enrolled in a grape growing and winemaking course that was offered through the university at Orange. That was when it was the Orange Ag College. And there were a couple one was an expert in viticulture, and another one was just starting out growing grapes at that stage. Stephen Doyle, who has Bloodwood Wines in Orange, and then Peter Hedberg. They're both quite well-known in the Orange region to be some of the pioneers of grape growing and winemaking there. So I did a weekend course with them, and then shortly after that, I studied at CSU and did a four-year course through Wagga Wagga while I was working in my other career. So that was the beginning of my quest, I guess, to get into grape growing and winemaking in Australia. Then after I finished my degree at Charles Sturt, I went back to Illinois and helped the family expand the vineyard and winery there for a couple of years. By that time, we had already bought the property here in O'Connell, and I knew I wanted to grow grapes and eventually make wine. And that's when I came back from Illinois in 1997, we planted the vineyard here.
And you've worked with a number of other local grape growers, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, in 1997, the first thing that happened, besides me and my family growing grapes and planting our vineyard, was that we started up an association. So we had a group. There was like maybe 12 or so in the initial Vignerons group, which included Bathurst, Oberon, and even going into Lithgow a bit, although there weren't a whole lot of vineyard owners in Lithgow area. Mm. There certainly were in Oberon and still are. So that was in 97. And then in 2000, I was very lucky to be offered a full-time position as a grape grower winemaker at a winery just outside of Bathurst called Winburndale Wines. Mm-hmm. So I was there for 11 years, and that was where I was really able to learn the hands-on grape growing and winemaking, because I was just thrown into it at that stage. I knew I wanted to be a viticulturist, grow grapes. I didn't ever consider myself a winemaking, but during my time at Winburndale, it kind of just fell on my lap and
they came together.
And it just kind of came together.
I imagine it was a good experience working there for such a long period of time, because I'm assuming that it would have got you used to this particular environment around the Central
absolutely.
West.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
The Tablelands environment.
It was a huge opportunity for me. I'm so grateful to the owners, to Mike and Helen Burley, the owners there, because it allowed me to attend workshops, to meet other growers and consultants and experts in the area, and I just learned so much from managing that property. So yeah, it was a huge positive for me. And then in 2011, it really allowed me to be able to feel comfortable to go out on my own and try and make Renzoia wines a reality.
So was that scary to step out
onto
your own property and your own business?
Oh, yeah.
Were you worried about the risk at that time?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Really worried. But I had a taste for it. 13 out of the 17 years I was working full-time in the grape and wine industry, and I knew it was what I wanted to do. So I kind of explored other possibilities, like working at other places. But in the end, through encouragement from other grape growers and winemakers, I decided that the only answer was to try and do my own thing.
Totally commit,
which in essence I didn't really totally commit, because what I did at that stage was I just had a small vineyard here, so I knew I needed to get other grapes from other places. So that's when I established strong liaison with the Mount Panorama Estate Vineyard just outside of Bathurst in the middle of the race circuit, and the Baxters there. And then I also established a strong partnership, or whatever you want to call it, with Tony and Liz out at Vale Creek Wine. So that's where I've made my wines for the last 8 years. But I didn't have to spend all that money on the infrastructure right away. So it really allowed me to kind of be able to pursue my passion, give it a real red-hot go for 7 or 8 years, and see if it had legs. So that's about where I am right now, really.
And what have been the challenges, if we just look at your own property here, what have been the challenges in terms of setting things up and keeping it going?
Yeah, plenty. We have, for many years, we had a label that, and we still have the label, called Dog's Day Chardonnay. And on the back label, it had a whole story about growing grapes and making wine in an area like O'Connell, cool climate. So you have all those challenges in a cool climate area, a late frost in the spring. You have the challenges with the, early frost in the winter. So you need to have that ripening period enough to grow the grapes. You have to choose grapes that are going to be able to handle cool climates. Then you also have water problems, because even though it's cool climate, there's only really just enough water to keep the vines growing. And in fact, you do need some, at least in the beginning stages, some irrigation that you can, supplemental irrigation that you can give them just to almost keep them alive, really.
And so, did you have to discover how much water you needed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it was a nice learning curve, because while I was at Winburndale, I was doing the same thing, and I had access to a lot of experts that would help me in that area. So, but it was very much learning about, and every site is different, so you're learning about each site based on its water holding capacity, and even in the same vineyard, you're going to have top of the hill is going to be much different to the bottom of the hill. Soils are all quite different just in one little mesoclimate. So there's a lot to learn.
Did you have any failures, any crop failures?
Yeah, plenty.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was talking about the Dog's Day Chardonnay label, and on the back we had the whole story about, you know, every dog has its day, and it was all based on dog sayings that are related to how difficult it is growing. So the first thing that happened was, of course, we planted in the middle of a drought, and we didn't have irrigation. We had a dam, but at that stage we didn't realize that the dam was virtually worthless. Our youngest was just born, and our oldest was 4 at that stage. So we would come out, we didn't live here at that stage, so we'd come out on the weekends and with water bottles, whatever we could fill up with water, and we'd be watering by hand.
Yeah.
It wasn't very effective, but we were just trying to keep them alive. But so we would have lost a lot of grapes then, maybe 70% success rate, 30% that we lost. So that was the first year. And then at the same time, later on that year, we had cattle. The fencing wasn't good enough, so the neighbor's cattle came in. That actually happened a couple times.
They like grapevines, do they?
You know what they like is the nice green growth that's happening.
Oh.
So just as we're trying to establish the vineyard, the nice green shoots that are just getting up to the wire, and then the cattle and the sheep would get in and basically eat all that nice green growth, or the cattle would step on them. So there was that, and then around the fourth year, we finally got to the point where we had a crop. We didn't have bird netting at that time, and that's when we learned about the currawongs. And so we lost the whole, when we finally had some grapes coming, we lost that first crop. So yeah, there was lots that we learned and lots of challenges.
Didn't you feel discouraged?
Oh yeah, plenty. But fortunately it was a small thing, and fortunately, you know, we weren't relying on that for income at that stage, and I was
determined.
Excited and determined and passionate, I guess. Hate using the word passionate, but it's true that, you know, there wasn't anything that was going to stop me. So we just kept going, and eventually we got
and
some
fruit. How did you feel when you got your really good crop that you were then able to turn into wine? Do you remember that?
You know, it's one of the most exciting times ever, really. I can remember it at my family's vineyard and winery back in Illinois. I can remember it at our vineyard here in O'Connell. I can remember it at Winburndale. The first year here, I think we only had 10 kilos of grapes, something like that, some small amount. We might have made 3 or 4 bottles, but still, it was the first year, and it was very exciting. Yeah, and then the next year, we might have picked a ton. So we might have been talking about 50 or 60 cases of wine. It was just, it's one of the most exciting times ever. And along with that, I think that's probably the most exciting, but then the second most is when you get your first wine bottled. Because, you know, picking the grapes is one thing, but you still have to make it and get it into the bottle. So once you get the wine into the bottle, that's the other really special time.
Yeah.
It still is. Yeah. Vintage is still an exciting time, and bottling is too, because when we get the wines in the bottle, it's a tremendous relief.
What kind of grapes and what kind of wines have you made?
Well, the grapes we grow here at the O'Connell Vineyard, we grow Cabernet Sauvignon, a little bit of Merlot, and Chardonnay. Mm. So those were the ones that I've made for the longest period. And now, since we've had the vineyard at Mount Panorama, we also make some Shiraz, and we make a bit of rosé. We make single vineyard wines out of Shiraz and Chardonnay when we feel like it's good enough. So right now we've got, I always sort of joke about it, that we probably have too many wines, but I guess it's an indication of how much I love making wine that so we have about 12 different wines now.
And does this sustain you financially?
Yes, it does, as long as my wife continues with her real job. It sustains me quite nicely.
Yes, that's all good.
We're getting there. Now my son Sam, who's 25, he's got the bug now and really into grape and wines, probably as much as if not more than I was when I was around his age or a little bit older. So he's working with us as well. So we're getting there, which is why we're now looking at expanding our vineyard here and building a new cellar door and function area here, which may soon become a winemaking area as well. So we feel like we're now at a stage where we've done the hard yards, we've done the initial work, we know we can sell a certain amount of wine, we feel like we can make it as a business, whereas we weren't sure about it 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
So now we're ready to invest a bit more into the infrastructure and the certainty and the security of having our own things.
And do you have a favorite wine?
Well, that's a good question, Susan. Do I have a favorite? You know, I've always been a red drinker mostly, but I do like pretty much any wine. It's not like I don't like them. My favorite one at the present time would probably be our single vineyard wine from our vineyard here, which is our Bella Luna Chardonnay. And it's also...
What's
been
it like?
Very much an elegant, cool climate Chardonnay. So it has a lot of citrus and minerality. It has some nice textural components to it, as well as a really strong sort of crisp acid backbone. So very much on that more elegant, cooler climate Chardonnay. Mm. But there's still a lot of really nice oak and, as I said, textural elements in it as well. It's been really well received too by some of the better restaurants. In fact, we just that's an opportunity, I guess, to Skype about our recent achievement. We just got that wine into the Key restaurant in Sydney, so it's a three-headed restaurant.
Yay.
And there's a few other headed restaurants that are carrying our wines. Sam's been doing a lot of work. My son Sam has been doing a lot of marketing and sales work, and it's starting to pay off.
Sounds fantastic.
Thanks.
Once you have put together the new building and the extension to the vineyard, what do you think will be happening then? What are you hoping will happen then?
Well, what we hope to do is to expand upon our cellar door and functions here. So we hope by the end of the year we will have a space we can run maybe 4 functions, one per season.
Are these like tastings, are they?
Well, they'll be like long lunches. They'll be like special tastings under the stars where we'll have a focus at each one of the events. One will be a music focus event. Mm. They'll never be huge. They'll never be more than 100 people because we're not in a situation where we'll be able to do, you know, what they do in the Hunter or, you know, music in the big music festivals that they have in Mudgee and the Hunter.
Vineyard.
Those sorts of things, yes. So it won't be anything that big, but we'll be able to do functions, and then we'll be opening our cellar door for more regularly. That we're really looking forward to being able to do that, and even making our wines here in the next year or two. We'll be making our wines at our own place, so we're excited about that as well.
Well, it's good to hear that you are still excited, having gone through all of these challenges and losing your crop and discovering what it's like to try and grow grapes in our crazy climate. So congratulations.
Oh, thanks, Susan. It doesn't take too many triumphs to be able to continue.
Yeah, that's all good. We've been listening to Mark Renzaya, who is one of the co-owners of Renzaya Wines here in O'Connell. Mark, to finish off our segment then, you get to select a piece of music. Have you got anything in mind?
Whoa, I like a lot of folk music. So, see if you have some John Prine. It's very American cult folk music.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you. Thanks, Susan.
Woke up this morning, put on my slippers. I walked in the kitchen and died. And oh, what a feeling when my soul went through the ceiling and on up into heaven I did ride. When I got there, they did say, John, it happened this way. You slipped upon the floor and hit your head. And all the angels say, just before you passed away, that these were the very last words that you said. Please don't bury me down in the cold, cold ground. No, I'd rather have them cut me up and pass me all around. Throw my brain in a hurricane, the blind can have my eyes, and the deaf can take hold of my ears if they don't mind the size. Get my stomach to Milwaukee if they run out of beer. Put my socks in a cedar box just to get them out of here. A Venus de Milo could have my arms. Look out, I got your nose. Sell my heart to the junk man and give my love to Rose. But please don't bury me down in the cold, cold ground. I'd rather have them cut me up and pass me all around. Throw my brain in a hurricane, the blind can have my eyes, and the deaf can take both of my ears if they don't mind the size. Oh, man. I give my feet to the footloose, careless, fancy free, and give my knees to the needy. Don't pull that stuff on me. Hand me down my walking cane. It's a sin to tell a lie. Send my mouth way down south and kiss my ass goodbye. But please don't bury me down in the cold, cold ground. I'd rather have them cut me up and pass me all around. Throw my brain in a hurricane. The blind can have my eyes and the deaf can take both of my ears and the little mind aside. That's right.
I'd now like to welcome Barry Ryan to the program. Barry Ryan and his family have been in Oberon for a very long time, and he's used working dogs for stock work most of that time. Barry, tell us a little bit about the properties that you are managing.
I own a property of 680 acres, plus I manage 3,000 acres of small properties around the Oberon district, and mostly run sheep and cattle. Been here all my life, born and bred. I'm the fourth generation on the property, and I hope there's plenty more stay there.
When did your family first come to Oberon?
They come out as convicts and settled in the Lowther district and moved to Oberon in 1852.
And have you always had dogs working on your farms?
Yes, I've always had dogs. My father was a collie breeder. He was a stud collie breeder. He used to show them. Then Later on, when the motorbikes come in, we found the collies couldn't keep up, so we went into the kelpies, and we've been with kelpies ever since.
And can you tell us a bit about what the dogs do for you when you're working them?
The main thing is mustering cattle and sheep, and we use all-around dogs because we've got to muster out a lot of rough country, hilly country, where you can't ride motorbikes, and plus we use them in the yards when we're drafting, and it saves two men when you've got some good dogs can help you draft and back sheep and heel cattle. And we train them to handle cattle as well as sheep. When we train them, we mostly train them in with the cattle when we wean them, and the cattle get used to the young dogs and the dogs get used to the cattle, and we do a lot of cattle work with dogs because they've just been brought up together and it's a natural thing for them.
And how many dogs have you got at the moment?
Three working dogs. I try and always have three because you've got your older dog, your middle dog and your younger dog coming on, and you try and keep separate ages, and so you always got one older dog that's trained. Mostly I have my older dog, I train him as a lead dog, he goes out in front. My younger dog, he stays around at the back with me, then the pup, whichever way I want to train him, he can either stay at the back or he can go out as a lead dog and keep the lead steady all the time.
Tell us a bit more about the lead dog. How advanced are they, and what do they do in particular?
My lead doggy, if I'm on the road or if I'm taking cattle along a fence line, I can send him out in the lead and he'll just steady the lead and just walk along in front of him. And the cattle are trained to just follow him wherever he goes. The cattle will follow. And if there's any breakaways, then he can bring them back. And it's one of the most important things is to have a good lead dog to control the lead of the cattle whenever they're walking or running. You can whirl them back easy.
And what's the lead dog's name?
BJ, lead dog, named after the two people who bred the two fathers, Billy and Joe.
And what are your other dogs called?
Jet, he's my middle dog. The only reason he was called Jet is because he's fast. He wants to be pushing all the time from the back, so we named him Jet when he was a little pup. And my young dog, I've only not long got him, and he's ripped because he tries to rip the hats, the boots, whatever he can get hold of, he tries to rip them up, so we name him Rip.
Do you think it'll take a lot of work to get him up to the same speed as BJ?
No, I got him when he was 10 weeks old when I got him, and now he's 5 months. He's going on 5 months old, and I can go and move a mob of cattle and mob of sheep just with him on his own now, and he's going to be a champion. And I got him off my grandson, and got a kelpie stud and breeds kelpies, and he's got some real good dogs. But the trouble is, when I pick my dog out, it's different to what he wants because I pick a different type of dog to what he reckons I should be picking, but I'm proving him wrong so far.
So what do you look for in the dog when you are picking him?
I like to get a reasonably timid dog because a timid dog will always become a good one-man dog, and I don't like a dog that rushes too much because they've got to be steady working cattle, and I don't like them biting of any sort of bite. Can either hurt the sheep or hurt the cattle, so you just cut out on any biting. And I like a timid dog because he's always a good one-man dog. He becomes a good mate.
Ah, that's good. That leads us up to some stories of experiences that you've had with your dogs. Since you've talked about mateship with the dogs, I'm sure that there's a lot of reliance between you and the dog.
Yeah, well, that's the main thing with having a dog around with mateship. I've had the dog save me twice with snakes running between me and the snake, and I've come up off a motorbike once and the dog just stayed with me till I recovered good enough to ride the bike away. And you always, especially when you're spraying, if you've got a dog around, you can never have to worry about snakes because the dogs are always there on the lookout, and I've got them trained never to go near them but to bark when they see them. So when a dog barks, I know there's a snake about close, so you keep your eye open then. And it's good to be able to just walk around spraying without looking for snakes when you know your dogs are around looking after you.
And did you have an experience once with when you were riding a horse?
Oh, yeah. The saddle girth broke on me saddle and I come off a horse and land on the horn of the saddle in the middle of me back. Couldn't move and the two dogs come and laid by me. Then me cousin and uncle come and they was frightened to come near me because the dogs were just laying there looking after me. Then when they spoke, the dogs, and I told the dogs to back off a bit, they come and I was all right. I got up and they helped me home, but the dogs would not leave and they stayed laying by me till they come to help me.
Oh, that's a great story. What do you think is going to be the future for working dogs?
Yeah, there's going to be always working dogs around, but the type of work they do is going to change because there's so many more smaller blocks coming now and they're going to be more all-around dogs. Once upon a time you had your sheep dogs that wouldn't only work sheep, but now they're becoming more all-around dogs. And a lot of them are coming sort of working dogs and companion dogs too. They're combining into both now and that because a lot of the farmers are getting older and their dogs are starting to become more companion dogs to help them around the farm, do little jobs and go and bring their hat and different things like that. And it's surprising the way people can train dogs to do things they don't expect them to be able to do. And dogs are a real mate when you train them properly.
What about, you talked about a lot of small farms, so people, I guess, are looking at alpacas and maybe goats or other kinds of animals that are sort of outside the traditional sheep and cattle.
Yeah, well, a lot of people reckon you can't take dogs near alpacas. I look after two properties that got alpacas, plus I've got alpacas and me own as guard animals. And I do all the work with the alpacas, with the dogs. The alpacas know the dogs know the alpaca, and it saves a lot of running and that when you go to get them in. I've surprised a lot of people with the way me dogs can work alpacas so steady and calm, and the alpacas get to like the dogs. They'll just walk around with them and follow them about and lick them, and it's just something that when they get used to each other, it's just a natural friendship thing.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much, Barry. I've been talking to Barry Ryan. Barry is a farmer in the Oberon district and he's worked with dogs all of his life.
Hey, hounds need a job. And this one suits me fine. Rounding up the and keeping them in line. I'm just a dog. But I'm gonna break if you don't let the string go. And I will be your friend. And a friend is what you need to move 1,000. And you owe me a feed. I'm just a dog. But you don't know my mother was a dingo. And you don't know I like to howl at the moon. Just a dog running ragged round the edges in the evening, running high on the silver of the night. You roll a smoke and I'll lie in the shade waiting for you. I'm not afraid of a little work. Take off your hat and pour a little water. We'll get those bloody ewes in the yard. A dingo is a dog, and a dog is a dingo. The lingo is a
And here's the lingo, just a dog. Running through the burrs in the Mitchell, running high on the silver of the night. I'm just a dog. But you don't know my mother was a dingo. And you don't know I like to howl at